as a registered nurse at McLean Hospital and as a research analyst in the Department of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's a good volume. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I know that it's probably been a long day for a lot of people, and we're at the end of the session, so I really appreciate the opportunity to speak. So in the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about some work that we've done at the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing to integrate transgender health topics into the baccalaureate nursing curriculum. I have no relationships to disclose. And before I get started, I just want to quickly note that I have the term transgender in my title, and I'll use the term trans or trans asterisk throughout my presentation. And to avoid spending too much time on a discussion of identity, I just want to note that as I speak today and as we're incorporating topics into the curriculum at Hopkins, our goal is really to acknowledge and include the diverse range of trans and gender variant and gender queer identities. So just to quickly outline our talk, first I'll go over a bit of background on the state of provider education, nursing, and trans health. I'll then give you as much detail as possible about the actual program we've implemented. I'll review our evaluation methods and preliminary results. So our efforts to integrate transgender health topics into the curriculum at Hopkins are really motivated by this underlying belief that if we integrate trans health into the curriculum, we will increase the number of providers who are able to provide care to trans patients in a culturally informed way, will reduce the incidence of discrimination, and will increase access to healthcare for trans patients. Now, I'd like to note that the evaluation of our program is focused on its ability to train providers and not to draw a causal link between curriculum and health access, though we do hope that this work will contribute to future efforts to draw this link. But this slide is really meant to frame our work in the context of broader trans health inequities, as well as trans healthcare access that, thanks to the excellent presenters who preceded me, I really don't need to spend too much time talking about. So we know from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey that 50% of trans people report having to teach their providers about care, 25% report having to postpone care due to disrespect or discrimination. The National Transgender Discrimination Survey doesn't report variation in discrimination by provider type, but we can likely conclude that nurses are providing a sizable portion of this care to trans patients, given that they represent the largest segment of the U.S. healthcare workforce. As a quick aside, I want to acknowledge that the term nurse can be used to describe clinicians with a range of educational degrees and training. This can sometimes be a bit confusing, so sometimes it's helpful to distinguish between registered nurses and nurse practitioners. Registered nurses make up the majority of the nursing workforce. They either have an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. The majority of registered nurses have a bachelor's degree, and this number is continuing to increase due to policy changes and payment incentives. Nurse practitioners have a master's degree or a doctor of nursing practice degree. Our intervention is targeted towards students who are earning a bachelor's degree to become registered nurses in an accelerated 17-month program. And we know that baccalaureate or bachelor's degree programs like the one we're working with graduated a little over 100,000 new registered nurses in 2014. As a point of comparison, allopathic med schools graduated around 18,000 new MDs in 2014. So all this is to say that educating nursing students in baccalaureate or bachelor's programs has the potential to impact a large and important segment of the healthcare workforce. But despite how critical training baccalaureate nursing students is, we know that nursing programs dedicate around 2 total hours to LGBT health, and we're not sure how much of this, if any, is dedicated to trans health. All right, I jumped ahead. Okay. So, motivated by this lack of training, we established the Transgender Curriculum Integration Project at the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. We worked with faculty members to weave content into 5 courses across the 3 semesters of the 17-month program. And we developed curricular content using evidence-based guidelines on trans health whenever they were available. We consulted trans health experts and community members to confirm our findings, to discuss preferred best practices when we identified conflicting recommendations, as well as to inform content development in areas where trans health guidelines or evidence-based guidelines don't yet exist. So just to quickly walk through the changes that were made to the curriculum, you'll see that 168 students started the program in September of 2014. all of the students received an introductory webinar that we developed, Trans 101, in one of their first semester courses. Then they received content in four specialty courses that were woven throughout the rest of the program. And the content they received in these courses was integrated into existing lectures. So we evaluated changes in students' knowledge and beliefs about transgender health using one pretest and two post-tests. We developed this survey tool that we use based on one used by Kelly et al. To measure changes before and after the implementation of an LGBT health curriculum at UCF Med School. And they based their survey on the Index of Attitudes Towards Homosexuals and Blumenfeld's Framework of Homophobia. And they added questions to account for the unique experiences of med students, as well as to account or ask questions about gender identity. So we made further changes to account for differences between medical education and nursing education, as well as to address beliefs exclusively related to trans populations. So just to quickly walk us through our evaluation, as well as the changes that were made. 168 students were emailed the pretest before they received any content, and 80 students filled it out or completed it. They then received the introductory webinar as part of a required homework assignment. Shortly after, they received a post-test, and 43 out of the same 168 completed the post-test. And then this coming December, students will be emailed a second post-test to evaluate changes made throughout the program. So in the analysis that we're presenting today, we're really evaluating the impact of the introductory webinar, and we're doing that with the pretest and the first post-test. So before I dive into the results, I just want to make a few quick notes that will hopefully help to clarify them. First, respondents answered each question using a Likert scale. And for each question in my analysis, I dichotomized responses into two categories, a gender-sensitive category and a not gender-sensitive category, and the neutral, neither agree nor disagree response, I included in the gender-sensitive category. For example, if the question was, I have the skills to care for a trans patient, and a student responded, strongly agree, or neither agree nor disagree, this was considered to be a gender-sensitive response. And our responses are also coded such that when we're looking at changes over time, positive changes indicated in green represent an increase in the proportion of students who had a gender-sensitive response, and negative responses in red decrease in the proportion of students who had a gender-sensitive response. So here we have some results. The first four questions we see generally high or positive beliefs at baseline and over time. If you look at number three, this is one of those reverse coded questions, so I prefer not to care for patients who are transgender. That 98% at baseline means that 98% of students had a gender sensitive or positive response, so they either said strongly disagree, or neither agree nor disagree. So in this middle section in red, we see some decreases in gender sensitivity or the proportion of students who had gender sensitive responses. Notably, we see a 14% significant decrease in comfort around people whose gender presentation is ambiguous. Number nine, we see an increase in skills or an increase in confidence and ability to provide care to trans patients. We also see a 17% significant increase in awareness of resources to where they can refer trans patients or get more information about trans care. So in this category or in this slide, our gender-sensitive responses are really correct responses because these were more factual knowledge questions, and I don't have the entire questions listed out because they're a bit long. And again, we see high knowledge at baseline, and that knowledge remains stable over time, essentially. These are some examples of the free text responses that students had both during the pretest and the post-test. And these responses were generally positive and excited about the transgender curriculum integration. They were asking for more case-based or scenario-based learning. They also were asking for more training for their instructors or professors. So if you look under the post-test, the professor also didn't know what cisgender meant when the term was brought up in class. Or, I thought this module was very helpful, but I wish it contained more scenarios to help me understand appropriate actions for commonly occurring encounters with trans patients. So the study was limited by our inability to follow individual students from test to test due to the specifics of our IRB approval, so we're relying on aggregate changes in responses to survey questions to assess our impact. We also had a low response rate on the second post-test. And there's a possible history or contamination bias due to students' participation in other programs at school or due to exposure to media. We're hoping to account for this in the second post-test by asking some specifics about this. For example, if they attended a transgender health panel that we had at the school this past year. So to summarize, after a 20-minute introductory webinar, students had some decreased comfort in patients or around patients with ambiguous gender presentation. This could be due to a number of things. It's a small sample size, so that decrease really comes down to just a handful of students changing their responses. It could also be due to some confusion with the wording of the question, or possibly to new awareness about these new topics and then potentially feeling uncomfortable. We do see increased awareness of trans health resources, which we were really excited about. Our major takeaways were that students were really accepting of the curriculum. Faculty were accepting of the curriculum. Students felt that faculty needed more training, and that students wanted more real-life scenarios and more interactive learning. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you to the whole panel. It is getting a little late in the day, but the panel was amazing and you're punctual. I don't think I've ever seen a panel that's been so on time. That is unbelievable. Let's just take a second. If anybody wants to stand up, you don't have to, but just take a minute because it's that time of the day. Does anybody want, because it felt good just now when I stood up. So the panel, you can feel free. Would you like? Okay, just let's take a minute. Then you can, formulate your questions. So we now have 25 minutes, if we'd like, to ask questions and then have some conversation, if you'd like, around all these different presentations. So anyone, feel free to have the first question. Yeah.
Yeah, my question is for Alex. I'm wondering if you're best at able looking at the negative. I'm just wondering if part of the reason that you're seeing those decreases at time two might be that the other responses really seem to be generally fairly positive to begin with. They just got more positive at time two. So it may be that that's what's driving the decrease in those questions where they're expressing increased discomfort at time two. Or I'm not even sure that it's. If you look at five, knowing somebody is transgender would basically alter the way I perceive that person. Just not sure that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, this survey that we use is sort of to evaluate changes in beliefs and attitudes throughout the entire program. And the webinar did not address each of these individual questions. And so some of the changes could just be random. They also could be due to, I think, just becoming more aware of topics that when they first took the pretest, it was sort of easier to say, okay, yeah, I'm okay with this or I'm comfortable with this. And then once they learned a little bit more about some of the issues that come up or some of the examples we gave in the webinar, is like there was a bit more potentially awareness of, oh, well, maybe I would be uncomfortable in this scenario. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So they were emailed the module. They had 2 weeks to complete it. The next day, the webinar was posted. They had, I think, a week and a half to view the webinar. And then as soon as the webinar was closed, they were emailed the post-test, and there were 2 weeks there.
Mm-hmm.
Another question?
Yeah, just slide up. So number seven,
My thought for this one is that the way this question is, again, some of these questions are confusing, and the negative and positive side can be confusing, but basically is that what this might be saying is what's going to sort of improve or help my beliefs about transgender people is my experiences with trans people, and only my experiences with trans people, and perhaps the decrease is people saying, well, you know, this webinar or learning about trans people in other you know ways will also potentially make me a better provider. So it's not only experiences with trans people that will alter my beliefs about gender identity, but potentially other things as well.
So number seven, it doesn't mean that it seems like it is, there's less likely to just.
So for number seven, when I first gave, sorry, now I'm confusing myself. So this decrease means, so they're all sort of coded positively. So at 18% baseline, 18% are saying that they disagree with this. Yeah. It's a test of proportions, a G-sample test of proportions. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that question, unfortunately. I'm sorry. But okay. Thank you.
Maybe in the follow-up,
I appreciate that.
Stats schmoozing.
That would be very helpful.
All right, other questions? Yes.
I have a general question for the panel. I often think about samples and representativeness. And I'm curious as far as there have been some dialogue around community samples and convenience samples being or not having diversity among community samples that are too focused on individuals that have high risk or individuals that are particularly dependent on social services. I wonder about what you think about diversity of these samples and whether or not we're characterizing and oversampling. I don't even think that there is such a thing as oversampling with trans populations, but you know what I mean, like it's just too representative, or it's not representative in the way that it ought to be, because we're not capturing that kind of diversity. So I'm just wondering, as a panel, in your various experiences all around the country, what you think might we do, and what we might suggest to do in terms of maybe introducing that kind of diversity.
Did everybody hear that question? Could you hear it in the back? Okay, great. So unfortunately, we have this weird taped mic that I don't know what to do with. So if we can go through and you can kind of come this way if you have a response.
I think it's a tricky topic. I mean, tricky thing to figure out, because I think we do need both. I think it's really important to have these large national data and population-based data for the states, all of that. But we absolutely also need, these more in-depth analyses of populations that are higher risk. So how to address that, I'm not sure. But inclusion and making sure these questions are included in all of the big surveys, I think, is super important.
I would echo that. I mean, it's definitely a challenge, particularly in the case of the Project Voice. We were specifically recruiting trans-identified individuals, so people who may not want to identify as trans or are not connected to social networks of other transgender people would have been missed. Even our recruitment and community centers and places. So, that's a challenge when people don't want to come out and identify and be part of it. At the same time, online recruitment, while it has its challenges, kind of gives people the space and the privacy of their own home to disclose, especially if it's not linked to personal identifying information. But thinking about about your study, you know, when you're community, where you're recruiting everybody, regardless of gender identity, then, you know, people have the opportunity to disclose and they're not feeling specifically targeted. So the extent I think that we can get national samples will really kind of be more descriptive of trans people generally instead of specific targeted communities.
Question. Was there a question over in this area now? I saw a hand. Okay. Yeah.
I'm wondering if any of you can comment on whether you feel like it's really important to include trans-identified folks on the team actually doing, like not just part-time with a community-based organization that does work in trans communities, but actually having trans folks on the team. And I think that there may also be a piece in there about what do we need to do to get more trans people into positions where they can actually be the ones looking at the data as it's being crunched instead of just getting the data on the back end and going, how many are we? And I know that, you know, I have a community in Seattle where we talk a lot about, like, what do we need to do to get more trans folks? What do we need to do to create an academic culture that encourages post-grad study for people who don't conform to gender norms? I'd love to hear your ideas about whether you had trans-identified folks on that sort of academic side of the team, and what kinds of things they were able to contribute.
I think in our study, we did have trans folks in the sense that from the academic side, none of them had been to grad school, but they were involved in the development of the intake survey, and in terms of like highlighting, for instance, our screening survey had a question about have you had any type of surgery, top or bottom surgery. And so that was a question that upset some of the trans folks that
sure.
Hurt their chest. And so that question in order just to make some of the materials more sensitive to participants. And they were included in recruiting other women into the study, in actually delivering the intervention. They were trained in doing MI and but there were some problems, and a lot of it had to do with kind of organization stuff. So an academic setting, a professional setting, where a lot of women hadn't worked in a professional setting before, and kind of the clashes that would happen between some of the trans folks and some of the academic staff, and they were, I mean, trying to satisfy the research end of it while also trying to make sure that we're sensitive to the needs of people working on the study is definitely
helpful. Yeah.
Thank you. I can also speak to that. The Project Voice, part of the study led by the Massachusetts Transgender Political Coalition, they brought the project to us as researchers to carry out. We worked collaboratively with the PI of the study, identified as trans, some of the folks recruiting identified as trans, and the survey development, so that there was community buy-in as well as like staff. But we're fortunate to be at a place like Family Health where we, you know, our LGBT health center, so we get a lot of people who apply for jobs who identify as transgender and white, transgender. So when we have research in this area, we really kind of not just include the direct team, but we open it up to everyone kind of at Fenway who wants to weigh in and be a part of the community. So it's really been a good model for us, and I think it's important to create opportunities. for trans and intersex folks to be involved in research to give back to their own community.
Just to follow up, our study is largely secondary analysis, but we do have in development of the analysis plan, as well as in one of our co-authors is transgender, identified as transgender, and he's a PhD as well, so he's a researcher, and as well as a community member. So I think it's really important, yeah, that we try to make sure that academia is not, we're just, you know, we're also including in our academic resources transgender people as well, so that can be part of all, you know, stages of the research.
And then as a transgender member of my team myself, mm-hmm. conducting the research, I think in my experience that disclosing myself to participants allowed them to be more comfortable in their responses and more honest, because I can actually relate and explain things that they weren't so sure about given our intake survey. But a lot of our members on our team were very knowledgeable about transgender issues, so it actually made it quite easy for everybody to relate and just be able to make people feel comfortable in order to have honest responses.
Oh, yeah. Did everyone hear that question? Yes? Great.
You know, in my experience, I've met lots of healthcare providers that aren't very knowledgeable in any sense in order to provide interventions for parents or kids. A lot of them aren't even knowledgeable about the process of transition, so it's a very much needed intervention that everybody needs to be able to access. Healthcare workers, teachers, counselors at schools, just people who do interact with parents, who can help in that ability to help a child transition in that sense. There's just a need for it. There's such a lack of it that, I don't know, it's just, yeah. All I can say. I don't have much knowledge because so much of the knowledge of the transgender community is being learned right now, even by ourselves. So it's just, I don't know.
If we have a moment, I'll take a moderator privilege moment to follow up a bit on the question just before, but a little bit from a different side. So I bet a number of folks, how much, raise your hand if you were at the panel yesterday morning, the gender affirmation, transgender variant. So a number of folks, but not everybody, but and probably a number of the panelists too. But one of the themes that came out, some of the panelists in particular who were talking about providing direct services work, working within transgender communities in Chicago, predominantly transgender women of color, but not exclusively by any means, they talked about really facing and talking to a public health audience, an audience of many researchers, many people within academia or within some form of research, facing the role of systems fatigue, the way they framed it, in the lives of transgender communities and the transgender women who they're working with. And research absolutely is a piece of those. So systems fatigue, they were talking about it in terms of the many different systems that people have to face on a daily basis and the exhaustion that comes from that. But also research is implicated within that. And that is, I think, a challenge for us to continue to think about as researchers and researchers invested in research that promotes trans health and trans health equity. So I would be curious to hear from all of the panelists what sort of the ways that you've worked with communities around issues related to research fatigue or other elements of systems fatigue, or what you might think about going forward, how that might influence future work, or in the case of thinking about training nurses, as in Alex's case, totally different perspective, but there is a systems fatigue element perhaps in thinking about the training of healthcare providers. So I'd be curious to hear about that.
loaded question. Yeah, just to push a little. Because it's, I mean, we're facing, you know, these are some real issues that I think we're facing.
Because I'm coming at it from a bit of a different perspective, it sort of answers your question in a somewhat different way. But I think that one challenge we face in terms of educating providers or educating nurses about different subpopulations is, for example, when I interacted with the curriculum committee about integrated transgender health topics, I was asked, well, can you also do the slides on lesbians as well? And there's this push to sort of, you know, really give credit, I'm not going to say it, but like to pick out subpopulations that are marginalized in different ways and say, well, here are the issues they face, this is what you do to best take care of them and move on. And there's a push, ideally, there's a push within providers to sort of take a step back and think about, you know, well, there's not one way to work with every trans patient or one way to work with every, you know, patient of color, but here are some tools that we can provide you with to ask and to understand and to apologize if you mess up. And there's resources that you can go to so that you're not relying on your patients to give you all the information that you need. So I think it's from a bit of a different perspective, mm-hmm. but just in terms of thinking about different disparities and all the different like subpopulations that providers potentially need to learn about, maybe taking a step back and trying to frame it from a let's keep an open mind and ask questions rather than, you know, putting people into categories and mm-hmm. trying to teach them everything that there is in them.
And maybe to get a little bit more concrete, perhaps so V and Lena and Jackie, you talked specifically about different kinds of recruitment strategies that you've used, that also involves then varying levels of working within or collaborating with transgender communities in your various settings. And so are these issues that have come up in your work and how they've been addressed?
I can say that, so I've worked in other studies involving trans health, life skills, which is it, HIV prevention, intervention for young trans women. And the majority of participants in that study were research naive. It was the first time they've ever participated in a study. And so, you know, there was a lot of building trust around research and getting involved and how we were going to use information and that kind of thing. I think one of the things to be cognizant of is, particularly with individuals who are low income, you know, these monetary incentives can, you know, potentially be coercive, and folks, you know, once they realize they can make money from research, you know, are looking for other opportunities. And so it's kind of a balance of like providing a service, you know, especially for an intervention trial where you know people are going to get information from it and not, you know, positioning things in a way that ends up becoming, you know, we're just taking data and information from people and not really giving back. So as far as the Cardiac Voice study, you know, the main outcome of that study was to show, to document experiences of discrimination in relationship to health outcomes. And so why it's called Project Voice is, just as you said, you know, if you can't count folks, then, you know, they don't exist. And so being able to have a voice in research, being able to have your lived experience being included in outcomes, and, you know, now that data's been presented before the Massachusetts congressional and Senate, and so that there's going to be movement around access to public accommodations on the basis of that close research. So it wasn't just collecting data, it really had positive, tangible outcomes for people, and I think making it very clear what the intention of this data collection is important, so people feel they're contributing something that's actually going to result in positive change potentially for the community.
Yes, in the fourth row.
So I have a question for Alex. I'm actually working with healthcare providers now and trying to get into more sensitive and culturally conscious in dealing with transgender women of color. And I get a lot of pushback on me in terms of, well, we don't need training on this, like we're sensitive enough. So I'm just curious if you got any pushback from the nursing faculty about whether or not there was really a need for this or to make them they really had the
brought it up to nursing faculty members, they were so excited. Every single faculty member I spoke to said, I've had this situation where I haven't known what to say. I've had a student who's come to me with this situation and we didn't know what to do. And I think that, I don't know if that's unique to where I was working. And I don't know if you're working in a clinical setting or in an academic setting, and there might be some variation there. And in terms of practice, like, you know, nurses who, or healthcare providers who are working with patients every day, as opposed to providers who are more interested in teaching. And,
right.
But no, I haven't, even in when we see sort of like a high baseline knowledge, there's excitement about it, which has been nice.
We have time for, oh, yeah.
I was just saying, but I'd love to talk to you after and hear some more about your experience.
We have time for one more question. Fairly short one. Do you have one? Or is there? Well, actually, we should check first. Anybody else who hasn't yet gotten their burning question up? Then yes, please.
Well, I want to move back around to your question around systems fatigue. I think that for me, not all systems, right, are negative. There are certain systems that traumatize, and you know, that's true. And so I think that the experience of, I think it's the conflation of systems, incarceration, negative school experiences, negative family experiences, those represent system experiences that then traumatize, I think traumatize and young trans women especially have to face. And then it's conflating those, that trauma, onto the school system, for example, going back to school, going to college, and then just having that trauma completely impact and negate, taking steps towards positively interacting with systems, that then is problematic. So I just wanted to think, I just want to ask whether or not the panelists have thought about like trauma-informed care, trauma-informed strategies, methods that actually attempt to address kind of research fatigue and potentially this trauma as a result of interacting with various systems, and then moving forward.
That's something that I think is really needed, because a lot of times I was one of the facilitators in the CBST sessions that we would do, and some of the women would share some really horrific experiences that had happened to them, and I'm not trained to deal with that, in an appropriate way. And most that I can do is, we have clinical psychologists that they can talk to, but I think it would be great to be able to kind of on-site to, to offer something more than a workbook, essentially.
Well, if there are other questions or other follow-up to that excellent question, can gather here up front. Join me in thanking this panel one more time. Thank you all for coming.